Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 231, for Monday, December 28th, 2015, the year's best. Hey, everybody, Leo Laporte here, and we have a very, very, very special triangulation. I know I say that every week, but it is. It's always a special triangulation because we've talked to so many great people. This year, because we're taking the week after Christmas off, we thought it'd be great to bring you some memories from 2015. Shows you may have seen, shows you may not have seen. But this must have been a fun one to put together. Carson, did you put this one together? I'm really excited. I can't wait. I don't even know how I would pick the best of 2015 because we had so many great guests. But for your delectation and pleasure, here you go. The best of the year 2015. We'll be back next week with a brand new triangulation on January 4th. I'll see you then. And Happy New Year. Maybe you know, if you're a fan of the history of Apple Computer, you might have read about the story of Apple Computer and one Ronald G. Wayne. When Steve Wozniak was 25 years old, Steve Jobs 21 years old, and they first conceived the notion of creating a company to sell the Apple I computer, they approached a coworker of Jobs at Atari named Ron Wayne. They said, "Can you help us form this company?" Ron agreed for 10% of Apple Computer. A little later on, maybe a few weeks later, he got cold feet and he said, "You know what, guys, I'm afraid of incurring some liability here. Good luck, but I'll see you later." He went back to work at Atari, never made a penny off Apple Computer. If he had kept his 10% stake, who knows how much he'd be worth. But does he have any regrets? I don't know. Let's find out. You met Steve Jobs when you and he were both working at Atari. Is that right?
That's correct, yes. He was a consulting engineer. I was the chief draftsman and product development engineer, and for a period of time, international field service engineer for Atari. I worked for them for about 3.5 years, and Jobs and I became quite chummy during that period of time.
Now, I've read some of the stories about Steve at Atari. He was quite a character. Do you remember that side of him, the barefoot boy who worked?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. He was a most unusual individual and had a characteristic of being extremely focused. He always knew exactly where he wanted to go, and you never wanted to get between him and it, or you'd wind up with footprints in your forehead.
Woz tells me that, too. Woz used to say, every time I'd come up with another idea, Steve would say, "Hey, that's a business."
Yes. Yeah, he was constantly looking for a business. At one point in time, he had, of course, knew that I had been in the gaming machine world, and I had a corporation of my own in Las Vegas previously, designing and building gaming machines, had several of them qualified with the Gaming Commission. And he walked into my office one day and said, "Hey, I can come up with $50,000. Suppose we go into the slot machine business." And I told him that would be the quickest way I could think of to lose $50,000. And that was the last we ever talked about it.
I think you had lost money by then, or was that later?
Oh, yes. No, it's the story of my life. Day late and a dollar short.
No, Ron, you don't seem too unhappy.
I've always followed the same philosophy. Whatever happens, you deal with it. That's all.
Yeah.
I was a holder of about a dozen patents, and I'm not talking about flashlight keychains. I'm talking about fundamental concepts. And that was from 1964 to 1972. I had acquired a good number of product development patents. And out of all of those patents, which included, among other things, the first significant advancement in analog electric meters since Darcenval 150 years ago.
Wow.
And out of all those patents, what I recovered in round numbers was about as round a number as you could get.
Zero?
It took me quite a while. Absolutely nothing. I never saw a dime out of any of them. And it had taken me all those years, because I tend to be a little thick on these things, to realize that the U.S. is the only industrialized country in the world where it is not a crime to infringe on a patent. Which means, of course, that an inventor has the right to defend himself for 17 years against GE, Borg, Warner, Westinghouse, or whoever else wants to steal it from him in a civil court. And, of course, any civil attorney will tell you, whoever goes into court, like whoever goes into a poker game with the most money, is virtually guaranteed to win.
Yeah.
So the independent inventor is not appreciated in this country.
On this show, had Nolan Bushnell on not so long ago talking about those early days at Atari. I don't know how much Nolan remembers of Steve. It seems like you perhaps had more direct contact with Jobs during those years.
Oh, I'm sure that Nolan had extensive contact with Steve, and Steve was very productive and beneficial to Atari. I think the most significant situation was I was international field service engineer at the time, and I used to get these communications from a company in Germany that had bought a huge, almost a warehouse full of Pong circuit boards that a lot of them weren't working very well. They had sent out a tech to help this guy get these boards working again. The guy was an absolute twit. I got these phone calls, very belligerent phone calls from Germany, screaming about who's going to fix these boards for us. And finally, Nolan sent Steve Jobs out. Jobs went out there and just in a matter of days was just spitting these things out like popcorn. And the phone call, the tone of the phone calls from Germany changed dramatically. He did a magnificent job, and I'm sure that Nolan remembers that.
Oh, yeah. What was it that Steve Jobs had? You obviously, and Nolan Bushnell obviously, noticed something unique in this young guy. I mean, he was in his very early 20s.
And extremely aggressive and constantly searching for something, primarily some form of business. He was absolutely business motivated. And where Steve Wozniak built this personal computer as more or less a lark. Everything that Wozniak did, he did for the fun of doing it. And Jobs saw it as a business venture and immediately focused himself on driving this into an enterprise. And that's when I came into the game, and we founded the Apple Computer Company, which, of course, had nothing to do with the corporate entity that followed.
Really excited to have Danae Rinkleman on with us. Danae is the founder, one of the founders, and chief, what do you call it, chief application officer at Indiegogo.
Development officer.
Development. Hi, Danae. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So how would you distinguish Indiegogo from Kickstarter?
Well, first and foremost, our philosophy is the biggest differentiator. We believe in democratizing access to capital. So when we launched, that's why we didn't have any kind of gatekeeper or application process. The last thing we wanted to become was a gatekeeper ourselves, where we decided which ideas had a chance or not. And so we launched a platform where anyone could create a campaign, and then your success is based on how hard you're willing to work and how much your audience cares. So we actually built an engine on the back end, a data-driven engine on the back end to help promote and spread ideas that are actually gaining traction and getting a lot of audience response, and the campaign owner is working. And so that's why we built Indiegogo to be a very much a meritocracy, and why so many people use us is because their destiny is completely in their control. The second biggest difference is that we really built ourselves to be an amplification engine. That's something we take very seriously. Indiegogo and crowdfunding, it's not a just put up an idea, walk away, and hope the world sees you. We've actually built a mechanism where the more effort you put in, the more we promote you and the more we share, or the more we help you find your audience, whether they're in your network or not, or whether they're on Indiegogo or not, it doesn't matter. We'll help you find your audience out in the world and give you access to more people than you could ever do on your own. And so those are kind of the two biggest differences. The other difference is we're global. We're in every country. We have, you know, contributions coming in from at least 70 countries every single week. We have campaigns from every single country. So we do have this global audience that we provide access to, for which for a lot of inventors or entrepreneurs who are building tools or products where their audience is global, that is very, very beneficial.
Was your original vision creators of content, filmmakers, artists, musicians, or did you?
We took the Amazon approach. When we launched, this was before the word crowdfunding existed. We just knew that the internet was a more robust way to connect with your community, build that community, and raise money for an idea. That was our hypothesis. That was the premise. And so that's what we set out to prove. So when we launched our beta and we picked just one vertical. And at the time, because I'd been working with so many filmmakers from my prior frustrations before starting Indiegogo, and because my co-founders, they were film lovers themselves, they'd been going to Sundance for years, we decided, and we knew the pain point was incredibly strong with filmmakers trying to get their stories told, that we decided to start there. But we quickly, within a year and a half, we expanded, or a year maybe even, we expanded to everybody after we kind of tested the waters and started getting, you know, this product out there that people could use. Again, this was the first one. So we weren't trying to be a better, faster, cheaper version of anything. We were trying to reinvent a whole new way of raising money and getting ideas off the ground.
He is the co-founder and chairman of the Singularity University. He is the founder and chairman of the XPRIZE Foundation. And I am thrilled to talk to, and let's not forget the planetary resources. Thrilled to talk to Peter Diamandis. Nice to talk to you, Peter. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
What's interesting is you were training to be a physician. Did you ever practice?
No, I got it right the first time. And I have the distinction of having graduated medical school and running two companies my fourth year of medical school. I got my diploma and bolted.
Wow.
I sent a photocopy to my parents and never looked back.
I have the feeling you were always interested in space a little bit.
Yeah, since my childhood.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a kid of the 60s, born in the 60s, grew up on Star Trek, Apollo.
Yep.
The belief that the cosmos was ours to inherit, and pissed off that we weren't going faster. And the rest came from that.
I'm a little older than you. I'm 58, but I grew up watching Walter Cronkite and Apollo, started with Mercury and then Gemini, then Apollo and the whole thing. And I would stay up and I would watch. And if there was a hold, I didn't care. I'd watch Uncle Walter dismantle the rocket ship, put it together again, all while waiting for the rocket to launch. And you're right. After Apollo, it was like we flatlined. And that was so sad. So is that what prompted you to create all of this stuff?
It was a realization that stuff was moving much slower than expected.
Yeah.
That honestly, it should be going faster. And then the realization that NASA was never going to recreate Apollo.
Yeah.
And that there was a new engine we could hook on to our dreams, and that was that of commercial space, and that the technology entrepreneurs now have to do great things is rivals what governments had 20, 30 years ago, and why can't we do it ourselves? And that there was more wealth to be created in space than was imaginable. And so that was the mantra, the mindset that got me going with Zero-G and XPRIZE and Space Adventures and now Planetary Resources and many companies in the future.
Private space exploration. Is there still a role for governmental space exploration?
Sure. Yeah, the government should very much be going out and seeing if there's life in Europa. Should be looking for planets around other stars. They should be doing the stuff that has very little economic upside, that is truly pushing human science and frontiers. But every place possible, the government should be contracting entrepreneurs to take the risks and doing things cheaper. You know, it's what, you know, the t- timing is everything, and the fact that Elon Musk had started SpaceX in early 2000s, just before the shuttle disaster, the second shuttle disaster with Columbia, and left the U.S. with a launch vehicle, and the government was, do we go through a multi, tens and hundred billion dollar development, or do we take the risk with entrepreneurs? They took the risk with entrepreneurs, and there's been dividends paid as a result of that with the Falcon Dragon system.
So, and you talk about this in bold, the word moonshot almost belongs to you, the XPRIZE, $10 million fund to facilitate private space exploration to get people thinking along those lines. I think planetary resources is interesting, though, because it doesn't make sense to do private exploration unless there's some profit there.
Agreed. And planetary resources has a number of different elements to it. People know only about sort of the precious metal side, but we're building a brand new generation of space drones. Think of think about quadcopters for space, if you would. These are very low cost. Much of the propulsion and tankage are 3D printed. They've got AI on board. They have laser comm communications. These are the Imperial probe droids, if you would, except we're the kindler, gentler version of that. We're the Rebel Alliance, not the Imperial Empire.
Oh, thank God.
But these are the Imperial probe droids that are able to go out to Phobos and Deimos, the moons of Mars, go out to the asteroids, go out and look around very, very low cost. And we're excited about the idea of being able to do this because some of these asteroids that come very near the Earth, near-Earth approaching asteroids, are very rich in useful materials. What are those materials? The low-hanging fruit is fuel, hydrogen and oxygen. If you can remove that as water, and these asteroids are 20% water by weight, water off these asteroids comes off very easy. If you just heat them up and the water boils off, you can have them hit a cold plate and then get a buildup of water, of ice. You can bring back to low Earth orbit, and then you can break it up into hydrogen and oxygen for rocket fuel. You then have other materials, nickel and iron, which if you break it up into fine particle size, 20 to 50 micron, you can use it for laser sintering and do 3D printing in zero G. Or finally, some of these asteroids are 1,000 times more rich or concentrations of platinum group metals, platinum, palladium, iridium, and so forth, which are very useful for electronics, medical devices, displays here on Earth. And, the book I wrote previous to Bold was a book called Abundance. Mm-hmm. And Abundance was all about this mindset that really – technology is the force that takes what used to be scarce and makes it abundant. So if you think that, platinum or platinum group metals are scarce, maybe they are on the Earth's surface. But if you look beyond the Earth's surface to, the low-hanging fruit of the solar system, it's abundant.
I got somebody to talk to right now that I'm pretty excited about. Mr. Neil Young joins us.
I just want all of our viewers to know that I don't sit in an office with a picture of myself on the wall. Where is that picture? Oh, here it is here. Yeah, I don't do that. I happen to be in my manager's office.
Oh, okay. Well, he would do that.
And, he would do that. And that's why this is there. I would have, maybe I would have put a picture of Bob Dylan up there or something.
There you go.
Or Jay-Z.
Yeah, there's so many things I want to talk to you about. I've been a fan for years. I have... I bought recently a live recording of you in Toronto from many, many years ago. One of your early recordings.
Massey Hall?
At Massey Hall.
Yeah, that's a good recording. Oh. That's a live 7.5 inches per second two-track analog.
Sometimes that's the way to go, isn't it? Just kind of simple.
Well, the closer, it went through a little board to get to it, and it was being recorded, but this is the monitor mix that was going down when we were recording the multi-track. So, actually, you'll never get any better than a live analog, it never went to the multi-track. So it's first generation, and we went right from that to, the 192 resolution. And
And it's just you and a guitar, so two tracks plenty.
Well, yeah, kind of. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Simple. Yeah.
Yeah. And it is a beautiful. It's a kind of. They're moving a lamp in. You know,
you
can
bring the lamp. Could I get a lamp? Come on. Yeah. Where's my lamp?
Does your manager wear pink headphones?
What's wrong with this place?
They're stealthily trying to dress the set. Oh. Hey,
I could use these if you like these.
No.
The pink ones. I like, you know.
You're confident in your manliness. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, by now, who cares? You know, yeah, exactly. I'm happy.
Yeah, exactly. So I was very proud to the minute the Kickstarter went up for the Pono player. You know, I'd been watching you make the rounds for a couple of years, you know, on Letterman everywhere, yeah. Telling people about this. It was originally called Pure Tone, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct. Hey,
whatever happened to the Link Volt?
I drove it here to this.
I want one.
Outside. Wait a minute.
I want one. It's a 1959 Lincoln. One of the biggest cars ever made. It's a boat.
Yeah.
But you've put an electric, it's a hybrid. So you have an ethanol engine in it and a battery.
It has a battery bank. It's a series hybrid. It has a battery bank in it. It has an engine that runs on cellulosic ethanol, but the car itself always runs on electricity. The little four banger cellulosic ethanol engine, by the way, which is 86% less CO2 than gasoline, with using the combination of the generator to charge the batteries, and run the car. The car is a 55 miles per gallon 1959 Lincoln Continental.
Amazing.
So, it's a no brainer. I don't know why. I don't know why the big car companies haven't done this. We've actually shown, we have, you know, Ford has prototypes in a Lincoln, actually, that are, it's fantastic. It's incredible. The car has twice as much power as the other cars that are out there now, except for maybe there's an Audi that's close, has a better acceleration than the Tesla. It's like an amazing car. It's a Lincoln. And it's just sitting there waiting to be released. And then it's already been out there at the track, and the people have driven it and everything. It's fantastic. But Linkvolt is like the kind of like the predecessor of that. And Linkvolt has 55 miles to the gallon on the National Traffic Safety Board numbers, the way they compute that. That's in normal daily driving. And on an extended trip where that has about a 420-mile range.
That's better than Tesla.
Well, yeah, it has a generator. You know, you can go forever with this. You don't have a problem with that. And it'll run on gasoline, but I don't use it. I use cellulosic ethanol.
I'm glad to hear you drive it. That's so awesome. I know you have.
I drive it. It's my everyday car. That's what I use.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Pictures driving me crazy up here.
Why?
I keep seeing a picture of myself on the wall behind me.
You want to take it down, Neil?
No, I want the lamp. Where's the lamp? Bring the lamp. Okay, this has got to go. We got to take that. I can do my own set design. If you can do your set design, that's much cooler.
I'm sending Jason down with a lamp. He'll be there in about 8 hours.
Okay, great. I'm going to put it right here.
Oh, I'm trying not to be too overexcited talking to you, because I've been a fan for so long, and your music is so great. But I find this interesting. You know, we become friends with Roger McGuinn as well. He's kind of a gadget hound like you. He's kind of a geek. He built a solar refrigerator. Is this something that you've always been interested in? Is kind of fiddling with
musicians?
Stuff? It's musicians.
Musicians are geeks. Some musicians are wild mathematician electronic guys.
Right.
I fall into some of those. You know, did you hear about the guys that said that you can't tell the difference between high resolution audio on Pono and an MP3. Did you ever hear that story?
I know the guy, David Pogue, who was a New York Times writer for many years. He writes, he's a tech guy at Yahoo now. And he and I have kind of gone back and forth. He called it the Emperor's New Clothes.
Oh, yeah, Yahoo.
Yahoo.
That's a very appropriate name for the company.
He's a Yahoo. This guy,
he is Yahoo.
Yeah.
But he's working for Yahoo. But I got something here in this player that I want to show you. See that? Can you see that? Let me take
yeah,
that
let me,
right.
Yeah, let me get right up to
Let's
the screen
see if I
there.
Can get that.
So okay. It shows us MP3, AAC, then 4416, the CD resolution, and then the two higher resolutions, 9624 and 192. Can I choose for any one song? Can I choose?
That's the Pono Revealer. Yes.
I love that.
Online this week. That means that anybody who wants to check on Mr. what he said about this, they can check on it, and they can actually listen on a Pono player and hear the difference. And there must have been something flawed in Mr. Pogue's playback whatever that was.
Yeah.
Sorry about the picture here. I see that the picture keeps dissolving and going into super low res.
It's okay.
Kind of like Mr. Pogue.
It's like Santa Cruz in 1972. I'm enjoying it.
So this is the deal, okay?
Yes.
This thing now can show you on any 192 track, you load it into the Revealer, and the Revealer is downloadable. It's a free app on Pono Music World. So every Pono player can have this.
Neat. I'm going to do it.
Any 192 track you put in, or 96 track or whatever, it will show it and all the other resolutions below it. And you can switch during the playback of the song and listen to the different levels of resolution. I'll show you here. Here it is again. We're doing this little Mickey Mouse kind of thing. But if I press right up here, then we're up.
But I know what David's going to say. He's going to say, well, of course, they're going to make it sound bad with this software.
No. We use exactly the same algorithms.
Okay.
Exactly, because we're a professional audio organization, and I've been making records for 50 years. We use exactly the right stuff because we're not screwing around with our art form, okay?
All right.
It's an art form.
I agree. You're talking to the preacher.
Let's get David Pogue on here and wake him up. He's asleep.
I'll send a copy.
You can send that direct to the Yahoo Fort Knox Bank.
We've been kind of not fighting, but David and I are a little bit in disagreement on this. But so let me talk about it.
I know you are.
So first of all, as a musician, and anybody who performs live or works in a studio, you hear something very different from we as listeners here, because you're hearing it live. You're hearing the real music.
Well, unless you're a Pono listener.
Well, that's
We're listening to exactly the same thing. When I leave the studio, I load it onto Pono,
right,
and I take it home with me. I can listen to it in the car on the way home. I it's the same thing.
You were pretty outspoken.
What I did.
You were pretty outspoken when the iPod came out that this compressed music was just ruining the experience. What is missing? I guess you can hear a quality difference. Although I have to say, when I get to a CD quality, the difference between CD quality and 192 or 96. I'm too old to hear the difference, to be honest with you.
No, you're not too old to hear the difference. Come on.
Well, my philosophy is, if I can buy the Studio Master, I want the Studio Master. Why not have every bit of information?
Right. Well, I'll tell you what. I can hear the difference between a 192 and a CD and an MP3. Because I love music and I like to listen to all the music. I like to listen to everything on the records. But and feel it. Feel it. That's the important thing, is feeling the music. And the more you get, the more you feel. It's just the way it is. Now, you know, it's just real. It's the truth. It's what we made in the studio because we loved it. And now we want other people to have it.
I think I take a little proprietary interest in our next guest, because I've been watching her since the very beginning. Justina Zarek's new book is out. New York Times bestseller, I, Justine, joins us on Triangulation. Justine, Yay. Great to see you, and congratulations.
Thank you so much. I owe a huge part of this book to you, so it's so exciting to be here and chatting with you about it, and it's great.
I wasn't fishing for compliments.
I'm just saying, but you've got a lot of shout-outs in there, so.
Yes, thank you. I do appreciate that, and Alex Lindsay, too. I always credit Alex with being the first person to tell me about Justine Azarek. He said he was in Pittsburgh at, was it a WordPress event?
PodCamp.
PodCamp.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, I met this incredible woman. You've got to get her on. She's beautiful. She's brilliant. She's got spunk.
She loves technology, and she was one of the only people asking all these random questions in this class. I was like, so how does this relate to YouTube? He's like, we're talking about high-end cinema cameras. We're not talking about YouTube. But I'm like, but how can I use this to post this on YouTube?
So you were already thinking, you know, along these lines.
Oh, yeah, because I was already doing sort of the YouTube and sort of like the content creation stuff. So I was trying to figure out how I can sort of up my game. And he's like, what are you talking about? Like, this is this internet thing. This is crazy.
You were all way ahead of us, believe me. Did you want to be an actor? I mean, really, when you were a kid, there was no Twitter. There was no YouTube. So you couldn't really say, well, I want to be a YouTube star. Did you want to be an actress?
I don't know what I wanted to be. I don't think I really ever said I wanted to be anything other than a chef, which I can't cook. So that was just ridiculous. Still can't.
Why did you want to be a chef if you can't cook?
I have no idea, because we used to go to Bob Evans. It was like my favorite restaurant.
Oh.
I'm like, well, and it used to make me really happy every time I get my food. So I was like, well, I want to make people happy by cooking them food. So I have no idea.
That's hysterical. Sure. So in kindergarten, they'd say, what now, Justine, what do you want to do? And you'd say, I want to be a chef.
Yep, that's it.
And a YouTube star. And the teacher said, what the hell? There's no you-hoo?
I mean, then for a while, you know, I wanted to do programming. I wanted to.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I started.
So you were enough of a geek that you wanted to maybe get a career in computer science.
Yeah, no, that was originally what I was going to go to school for. And then at some point during high school, I realized, well, my instructor was like, you know what? Your front end designs are way better than your code, because I would spend so much more time trying to make the programs look pretty than actually work. So that kind of was really important for me, because I was like, you know what? I can actually do the front end stuff and leave the other stuff to other people. But yeah, I still like learned like ActionScript and C++ and Java and all that stuff enough to be dangerous to sort of carry over into like web design.
I hope he wasn't being sexist though and thinking, oh, you're just a girl. You should be doing front end and not.
No, but my designs are really nice and everyone else's were really ugly. So everyone, we ended up
Do you still do some of that? Do you still do some?
I do. Yeah, a lot of it. So, although through, you know, the internet, I've met some amazing, like, graphic designers. So I'm like, you guys are so much better at this than me, so take over. Actually, one of my friends who saw me on The Price is Right, I never knew him in Pittsburgh. He actually designed the cover of my book, and that's how he found me, was from The Price is Right.
Oh, nice.
In 2009, and he's from Pittsburgh. But yeah, he designed the cover for me. He's amazing.
You did The Price is Right in 2009? I thought you just did it.
I hosted it recently, but I won in 2009.
What?
So
I didn't know. Yeah, because you hosted it. But you, so 5-6 years ago, you were on it.
Yeah, so I won the showcase. And then
what?
So they had me come back as sort of a guest model, but yet I was on it. So I don't think they've ever done that before.
That's a first.
I think it was actually a first.
You, really you won the showcase. I must have known that, because I knew you then.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people forgot about it, but it definitely happened. And actually, the computer that I was using even up until recently, one of the Mac Pro Towers, I won that on The Price is Right.
Oh, well, that's pretty sweet.
It was great. It was like meant to be.
That's pretty cool, yeah. I love I think you must also have wanted to be a model a little bit. I mean, you are in this book, these photos are fantastic.
That's just because my friend's a really great photographer, so.
Oh, I love these. These are really great. Here is 2009.
Oh, my gosh!
Justine Azarek, come on down! Did you know you were going to get picked?
Oh, no. My sister made us wake up at 4 a.m. to show up to do this, and then it was like the last thing I wanted to do. But it all ended up working out. They audition every single person. So
everybody in that audience, they've put on camera to see what you're going to do.
They do, yeah. They audition you.
Because they don't want any duds on the show.
No, they want some crazy people. So I just, like, went crazy.
And it was the 7,000th episode, which is kind of cool.
It was amazing. I can't believe
let me,
it.
Let me skip ahead to see you. See if we can watch you win the showcase.
So funny. Oh, actually, those same
there you are on the left. This is somebody's, obviously, somebody's recording from their living room.
Yeah.
The sound is terrible. Have you seen this since 2009?
I have. You know, I rewatched it fairly recently.
Oh, okay. She's gonna pass Justine.
Heather is gonna go down in history as the woman who lost to I Justine.
And she passed off.
Look at you! You're so young.
Oh my gosh!
And there's Jenna.
There's Bree. That's my other sister.
There's Bree. Oh my gosh! The whole, all three sisters. What does the T-shirt say? Pittsburgh girls.
I think he said Pittsburgh loves Drew, and then mine said I Justine loves Drew. 7,000
tweets when this airs. You said $22,000.
And this was back before, I think Drew had just joined Twitter, so he was very confused.
Oh, that's right. He and Drew Olenoff had a little battle over the name Drew.
Oh.
And Drew Olenoff gave him Drew. That was a whole thing. In fact, I think I was the one who suggested Drew Olenoff take another name. What? A segue? Did you win a Segway, too?
I didn't. No, I think that was her.
You're such an actress. You know what? This is so funny. You're perfect for this show because you're just, you're just a, you emote so.
I mean, I had to be a little, I mean, I was.
Yeah, that's the job. Look at that.
Dream come true.
Look at that. It's made, you're made for this show. $631
difference of. You can go back after 10 years of winning and try to win again.
You can, you're allowed. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's 4 years from now. You can go back.
Yeah. The reunion episode. I mean, I want to host The Price is Right.
I think you should host it. Forget this Drew guy. You're great.
When Drew's done, count me in.
I Justine loves Drew, it says.
Drew's great. He's really, really good at his job, too. Like,
there's your
welcome.
Sisters. Oh, my golly. Is your mom coming up, too?
No, I've met some other people from Pittsburgh in the audience. So I wanted them to come up, but they wouldn't let me.
I, Justine, winning the showcase on the 7,000th episode of The Price is Right back in 2009. We're going to take... this interview is all over the place.
It's great.
It's story fun. Of my life. If Hollywood came to call, and they are, aren't they, would you just chuck it all and become a movie star?
I don't think you can do that now. There's no way. If I was just doing movies, like, that would be all I was doing. And there's no way to tell people about the movie. And I think that's why a lot of, you know, Hollywood people and people in traditional television are tapping into this YouTube audience and the social media kind of thing, because we have the audience already. We're going to take the people to see it. And that's why it's awesome doing, for example, like The Price is Right. Yeah, I was on the show. And then now later on, I'm able to take my audience through this entire transition of, you know, being on the show, being a guest host and that kind of thing, and just bringing it all around and telling a full story. And one of the reasons that I even wrote the book was because I kept pitching a web series sort of based around my Justine character, and even potentially a movie or a TV show or something like that. And no one was really understanding what I was saying. So I was like, well, I'm just going to write the book. And then it's like, here we go. Here's the story. This is what I want to make. So I think that's really ideally what I would love to do.
Jenny Jardin's on the line. I'm so happy to talk to you, Jenny.
I'm happy to be here. I'm sitting here from my Yeti-lined lair.
You look so cool. You look so cool there. You look both... hip, artistic, and digital, kind of all meshed into one with the Time Life headsets you're wearing. It's very good.
These are great headsets that your people sent.
Yes,
I didn't have to worry about my hair because I knew it would all be smushed.
It's great. It's great to see you.
Life's too short to worry about.
I would just want to say up front, if I ask anything that's too personal, you just shut me down and say no, too personal. Sure. Okay. But I want to know about you, because we know of you. We've all been reading Jenny in Boing Boing for some time, one of the founding partners of Boing Boing, the fabulous, it was originally a zine, but fabulous digital blog of everything interesting in the world. But I want to go back farther than that. I want to ask why Monica and Glenn named you Jenny.
Oh, wow. They didn't. The name I was born with was Jennifer Lorraine Hamm. And in my teens, I ended up, my dad died. He was a genius artist who was also had some untreated mental health problems and some untreated addiction problems. And he died when I was very young. He died when I was 10.
Mm. And oh, that's devastating.
I ended up on the streets at an early age. I had a lot of really rough experiences out in the world when I was in an age that's way too young to handle that kind of stuff.
How did that happen?
Well, you know, I just want to address the name thing real quickly. So,
okay.
I was on the street, you know, off and on from the time that I was like 14 onward.
Shimony.
And when I was, it was when I was 18, I met a very charismatic man who presented himself as a kind of a spiritual teacher and became part of what felt like a family. And it was I think it's fair to call it a cult. And in that experience, you know, I ended up spending a lot of time in Guatemala and in different Native American communities. This man was Native American. And I accompanied him on a trip to Guatemala to meet traditional Mayan priests, you know, who practice the day keeping and the traditional calendrical system. This man was he was like a kind of Latino Chicano theater person who had found a second calling, basically studying indigenous spirituality. So I went with him to Guatemala when I was either 18 or 19. It was my first year in San Francisco. I made my way out to San Francisco and met him, and you know, really. I hadn't had a family for a really long time. And this, you know, a cult can really feel like a family. We went to Guatemala during the war. There was a 36-year civil war in Guatemala, backed by the U.S. The Guatemalan government and military were basically waging war on indigenous people and on students and labor activists and stuff. But it was really a genocidal war, primarily against indigenous people, I believe, to gain control of the land so that things that are happening now, American and Canadian-owned mines coming in and stripping the land of its value, could happen. But at that time, it was 88, 89, the genocidal war was in full swing, and the government was actively, you know, bombing Native American communities, especially in the northern part of Guatemala. And, you know, here I was an untreated alcoholic and drug addict who was dry, because part of being in the cult was that you needed to be dry. 18, 19 years old, never been out of the country in my life, tagging along with this highly charismatic, very, very unusual man to Native American villages in Guatemala. And when I was there, I got very, very sick off of, water, food, or whatever. It was in the middle of war. And we were staying with very poor people, some of whom had just, like the village next door was razed and everybody killed. And we were staying in, like, the village that survived.
Wow.
I got really sick. And I remember I was like, lying in some back room of a hut somewhere, you know, just puking and crapping my guts out. And this little babies, it was a Kakchikel Maya village. These little cute little babies were kind of peering over the side of the bed like this, just staring at me for hours. And one of them was this sweet little boy with, like, they call them mocosos. It means like snotties. They had like snot coming out of his face. And he said, "What's your name?" "Tu nombre. Tu nombre." Like that. "What's your name?" And I said, "It's Jennifer." And he, in Kakchikel, the way they would translate that, like if you're a toddler who doesn't speak really Spanish or English, is Jenny Flores.
Oh.
So it was like Jenny Flores. And it was such a cute little portmanteau. Flores means Flores means flowers. And my name became Shani Flores, or Shani for short. Everybody started calling me that, and it became like my the man who is the leader of this cult said, you know, that's your name now. And that was really cool. And he gave me a last name, too, because nobody in my family was using my dad's name anymore. It was cool because I had an identity.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's where the name came from. I've actually never talked publicly about that, and, you know, maybe it's too much, but...
That's a great story.
I'm also kind of sick of people saying, like, you made up your name. Because it just seems it was so much cooler and more random than that.
it's a wonderful story. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Drew Curtis. It's great to see you. Hi, Drew.
Yeah, thanks for having me. How's it going?
Oh, it's wonderful. Congratulations. We had you a couple of weeks ago on the new Screensavers in an interesting conversation mm-hmm. about the role of social media in politics. But today we can go a little bit more wide-ranging. And I'm cool. sure there are people who are voters in the state of Kentucky watching. So we will try to keep out of any hairy areas. But at the same time, I think it's really important that we talk about the election too, the race, not just FARC, not just your history, but the election. Why did you decide to run for governor, all things?
Yeah, so it came out of a series of conversations I had with friends of mine about, you know, why don't good people run? It always seems like it's these career politicians, and you know, then they get up on stage and they don't answer questions, and they like to talk about to each other about how bad they are. And it's like, this seems like a terrible way to, like, you know, essentially, you know, interview a CEO for a kind of a vital position. And somebody challenged me and they said, why don't you do it? And I was like, well, it looks like it's hard, and which it is, as it turns out. They were wrong. But, you know, their point was, it's like, well, look, you know, the reason why good people don't do it is exactly the reason you gave. And, you know, you're an extrovert. You can handle yourself in the media. You've got reach online. And if you are unwilling to do this, then why would you expect anybody else to? And I thought, oh, yeah, that kind of makes sense. So initially it just seemed like a good idea. But then when I dug into the problems, I found out that I'm the only one who actually knows the problems that are facing the state, which kind of shocked me.
You're a third party candidate.
Mm-hmm.
What's your party?
It's actually no party. It's the I'm independent.
Independent.
Yeah, people keep asking me, is that the independent party? No, it's no party.
Well, that's actually hard because you don't have the support of a established party machine raising
Correct.
Money.
However, you remember we talked a little bit on the last show about how I've got sort of this theory that that political parties are social networks. So it turns out that you need a social network to win, but now we have social networks that are not political parties. And in fact, if somebody posed me the question, they said, you know, could a candidate win only using social media? And my response was, candidates have only ever won using social media. We just call them political parties.
Yeah, that's a good point. I've actually, from a distance, been a fan of Mikko Hipponen for, it's more than, like, 25 years. You may know his name. He's a computer security expert, a columnist, and chief research officer for F-Secure. Mikko, thank you so much for joining us today on Triangulation.
Thank you, Leo.
It's great to see you. You know, and the reason I've known you for so long, or known of you for so long, is we were doing a radio show, I think in 1991 or 92, John C. Dvorak and I, and the Melissa or Mailissa virus was spreading. This was a virus that was spread by floppy disk and email. Actually, it was the first virus to be spread by email, and so it was spreading.
That's one of the first email worms ever, yeah.
Yeah, spreading like a wildfire. And we helped people by sending them free copies of F-Disk. It was a DOS-based antivirus, one of the first.
That's right. Long, long, long time ago.
And still one of the best out there. So welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for 25 years fighting the good fight against malware.
Actually, I'll be here at F-Secure 25 years in June next year because nice. I joined in 1991. So, yeah. Very soon, quarter of a century at
wow.
the same place. So,
we've seen a lot of changes in that time. I mean, even Mailissa was a huge kind of wake up call because it spread so fast. Up to then, virus has been spread on floppy disks.
That's right.
Of all things, what got you into security?
Well, I was originally just a coder. When I joined this company, they didn't actually originally hire me to be researching viruses or doing reverse engineering or hunting hackers. I joined as a database developer doing just coding. But the company started expanding into new fields, including this brand new field of computer viruses. And I had a background of assembly programming and reverse engineering from my Commodore 64 days when I was 16 or 17.
Nice.
So when we needed to reverse engineer malware on MS-DOS-based systems, it was fairly natural to give the samples to me. And that's in 1991. I'm not 25 years later, I'm still doing it.
So you would have to look at the malware, disassemble it, and figure out what it was doing.
Sure. And in the early days, we had so little resources that we didn't, for example, have a spare computer to infect. They were expensive. So what I would do is that I would take these early COM programs from MS-DOS era, and I would actually open it up in debug and print out the whole code and on paper and have a stack of paper and a reference guide for the interrupt list of MS-DOS and go through the code on pen and paper and reverse engineer it manually, which nowadays thinking is just stupid. But, you know, that's the way we do.
You know what? I've done that. It's fun, isn't it? It's like detective work.
It is, but it's changed quite a bit. I mean, when our guys today here in our labs, when they look at complicated 64-bit, you know, Windows drivers, part of some rootkit for a modern exploit kit or something like that, it's a quite different ballgame. And it's basically the same thing we were doing 25 years ago, but the level of complexity has gone through the roof.
Actually, I have to correct myself because I'm thinking now, The virus that we were fighting in 91 on Dvorak on computers was Michelangelo.
There we go. That makes more sense because Melissa is probably, because it was over email, so it's got to be 98, 99.
Much later.
Something like that.
Yeah, much later. No, Michelangelo, that did spread from the from a floppy disk, from the boot sector on a floppy disk. Mm-hmm. And we were sending out, I remember I was making floppies with F disk and sending them out to fans. There you go. Look at it. You've kept those. Is that a library of viruses?
Yep. We probably have Michelangelo's stoned.
Stoned. Or like. Remember that one? Yep.
Mm-hmm. We probably have Michelangelo somewhere in here. Hey, could it be? Here we go. Michelangelo.
Look at that. So, not even what? On a diskette, on a floppy. Wow.
On a floppy, yep. The only one missing from this early collection is the first one, which is brain.a. So, of course,
Brain. Yeah.
We used to have that as well, but I don't have it anymore because I took a trip to Pakistan to the original authors of Brain.a, and I left my copy of Brain to them.
No kidding. They had lost it?
I don't know. I think they had maybe.
Did you autograph it, Mika?
I you know, when the first PC virus turned 25 years old, we had a discussion about, like, should we do something about that? And I had this stupid idea of going and trying to find the guys who did it 25 years ago. And I actually went back to where it came from, which was the city of Lahore in northern Pakistan. And I found the guys, and we had a nice chat about it. And I did leave my copy of Brain.a with them.
No kidding. So, okay, this is mind-boggling. So it's 25 years later. Presumably, they've grown up. They're no longer malware authors, right?
Obviously not. They never wrote any other malware except Brain.a, which turned out to be the very first PC malware ever. Now, be careful. We did have malware before PC malware. For example, Apple II malware existed like a year or two earlier. But, of course, PC malware is what really started the real big problems, and we are still fighting PC malware today. And during these years, these guys, it's actually brothers.
The Alfie brothers, yeah.
Yes, Basit and Amjad. Those are the guys I met. And what they're doing nowadays is that they are businessmen. They actually run a telco operator which provides fast fiber optic cable connections throughout the city of Lahore. And the name of their company, which they are running today, is called Brain Telecommunications.
Love it. Love it. I want to welcome our guest from the 2-Bit Circus, Eric, and how do you say your last name, Eric? I should have asked you.
Gradman.
I was going to say Gradman. Eric Gradman. Gradman is here. He's the mad inventor, partner at the 2-Bit Circus with his partner Brent Bushnell, who we were hoping to get on as well, but Skype did not permit because he's, of course, at a tech conference.
He's at an internet conference, so there's no, there's no internet there.
Congratulations, first of all. Two-Bit Circus just got a $6.5 million funding round, Series A funding round. That gives you guys the chance to really expand. And by the way, there's Brent on the left, so you get at least to see him. What is 2-Bit Circus, Eric?
We're a high-tech circus, and we are reinventing out-of-home entertainment, creating the next generation of entertainment.
Using technology.
Using technology.
In fact, you call it the Steam Carnival, which is science, technology, engineering, art, right?
Absolutely.
Got to have the art in there to make steam. You can't make steam without art. And then math.
2-Bit Circus generally is dedicated to creating the next generation of entertainment. We're doing out-of-home entertainment. We're doing virtual reality. We're applying technology to showing people a great time out-of-home. And that's what we do.
I think that's great. What's your background? Are you a scientist, an engineer, or performer, or all three?
I'm an engineer and a roboticist. And a
That's
performer. Sorry, both of those things. My training's in robotics, and I did that for many years, building self-driving cars and self-driving robots.
Oh, really? Interesting.
And at a certain point, I kind of stepped away from that, and I decided I wanted to make fun things.
Yeah.
And, man, I was under some serious NDAs. What can I say? I wanted to be able to tell people about what I was building,
what was
right?
What's going on, yeah.
And so building technology that shows people a good time is my thing. And I was also a circus performer for many years, so it's very natural that I should now have a technology company named 2-Bit Circus.
Many is the engineer I've known who can juggle, who can do a unicycle. Some can do both.
Yes.
I mean, there seems to be a natural kind of conjunction, but it's kind of a dual nerdiness, I guess. I don't know exactly what it is.
I think typing confers a great deal of manual coordination.
Is that it?
I don't know. It's a correlation, not causation here. But yeah, I know a lot of engineers who
it's
pick
very
up
common.
Juggling. And
yeah.
It's just amazing.
Yeah. So you were a circus performer, too.
Yes.
What kind of performance?
An acrobat, an aerialist,
that's
a clown,
neat.
A fire dancer.
Was that before or after the robotics?
That was simultaneous with getting my master's degree.
Interesting.
Yeah, so I was skipping a lot of class and on the road doing circus shows.
But what I love is that, you know, typically you think of one as left brain and one as right brain, but you've got both brains are involved here.
Trying. Well, I'll tell you, the thing about making performance technology, you know, making technology designed to be put in front of people, to be demoed, to be played with, is that it really calls on both engineering and it calls on performance. You know, you really have to understand both of those disciplines.
Right.
To call the performance a discipline is maybe a stretch, but...
No, I think it's fair. Absolutely. I mean, it is to grab an audience, to get them involved, get them emotionally excited about something is an art, is a real...
Totally.
There's definitely a discipline to it. And you have to work long, and as you know, work long and hard. I mean, if you're an acrobat, that doesn't happen overnight.
It does not.
Yeah. And you're a great whistler, too.
I am a great whistler.
when did that start?
I've been whistling since I was a little kid. My dad was also a good whistler, and I just grew up doing that.
Look at this. He's playing these flames.
Oh, this thing's awesome. This is a theremin Rubens tube. That was created by Dan Busby, who's part of 2-Bit Circus. And this is an amazing thing, because this tube full of propane, when you put a sound wave into it, will cause alternating areas of high and low pressure along its length. And the way you see that is with a fire that looks like a sine wave.
Wow. Right?
So that concept has been around for 100 years. What we did is we added a theremin to it. So,
so he's playing it.
Yeah. So you can walk up to this thing, and you can move your hands in and out, and you can control the sine wave of fire with your hands.
This is so neat. I love this.
Well, now, I'll tell you, unfortunately, that will not be at the carnival, because doing things with fire requires special permission from the fire marshal.
Yeah.
So if you're gonna use that silver bullet and ask for one fire thing...
The whole thing changes.
Well, you better make it count, which is why we're bringing our dunk tank flambé.
Okay,
so let me tell you about the dunk tank flambé. You'll find video of this online.
Even the name. I'm going to look for dunk tank flambé. You could be the only one, obviously.
There is no other dunk tank flambé in this world, I promise. So you know the dunk tank, right? The standard dunk tank. You throw a beanbag or a ball at the target, and your parent or your teacher or your friend falls into a vat of water.
Right.
Where we'd replace the water with fire. And so this is me getting into
You're
a
gonna
fireproof
do this? Oh,
suit.
Oh, thank God you've got that.
Oh, yeah. And,
Oh, my God, you're getting into an incinerator.
I'm just going to let this play, because...
And then people throw. Oh, kids must enjoy this.
Oh, they love it.
Because you're mocking them now. Is it hot in there?
It is. It's very hot in there.
Oh. Oh, that's mean. Oh. At the same time, kind of exhilarating.
It is. It's pretty awesome. Let me tell you, being in there is amazing. So we are going to have this at the carnival.
Was this your idea?
This was, you know, we came up with this. I think Brent, this was one of Brent's.
Brent said, hey, Eric, I got an idea for you.
He's been in this too.
Has he been in?
I'm just the guy who thought to bring the GoPro in with him.
Love the video.
Yeah.
And you don't get burned in that?
No. So that fireproof suit was made for us by Newtex. They make fireproof suits designed for the firefighting industry, right? And I'll tell you.
But I don't think they're designed to be like in incineration tube.
Oh, no. Those things.
Really?
Those things can hold up to much higher temperatures.
Really?
Through. Now, I'll tell you the one thing. I was not hot in that suit, except for body heat, because it traps heat in as well. So it gets a little sweaty in there.
Sweaty, yeah.
But the hands are made of Kevlar, right? The whole suit is made of an aluminized reflective fabric.
Right.
Really rejects heat.
Right.
But the hands, you want a little bit more manual dexterity when you're a firefighter.
Yeah.
So the hands have Kevlar on them.
Uh-huh.
And so the only part of you that really gets a little hot, and I'm not talking really hot, I'm talking
all
a little
toasty.
Hot. It's just in the hands. So sometimes I'm just kind of like this, you know?
Sit on your hands.
Yeah, it was fun.
If you, like me, are a collector of programming languages, if you love programming, if you love coding, we have a legend with us today. Larry Wall is the creator of Perl, the benevolent dictator for life at the Perl Project.
I don't want to be a legend yet.
Oh, too early, huh? Yeah, too young to be a legend.
Yeah, I'm only 61.
I'm sorry to say, Mr. Wall, you are a legend. Yeah. And it's not a bad thing. It's really not a bad thing.
I live about a quarter mile from the History Museum, the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, and I try to stay out of there.
Yeah.
I don't want to be history
yet. You don't want to be history yet. Yeah, they'll stuff you and put you up on the the wall there. Perl 6 coming out. Actually, it's in beta already. Mm-hmm. And that's big news because it's been, dare I say, 15 years in the making. That's longer than the original Perl, I would imagine.
Well, it depends on how you count. But yeah.
Yeah. we'll get to Perl 6. I want to talk a little bit about you, too, though. We have, as I mentioned before we began the show, a broad variety of viewers, some who are expert Perl users, and they'll have the expert questions for you, not me. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of us are also very interested in you and in when. So tell me a little bit about your start. Were you a computer science major in college?
No, I actually started off majoring in a double major in chemistry and music.
Perfect.
Yes.
Perfect.
Majored in a few other things in the middle. I'm one of these people who stretched 4 years into eight.
Yeah. Well, we're from that great generation that brought us so much innovation. But
I was fortunate to go to a college that let me.
That's nice.
Let me kind of figure my. I was a late bloomer.
So. Do you remember your first personal computer? Well, of course you do. Everybody does.
Well, my first personal computer was actually an Amiga because all the computers I had before that were at work.
Big ones.
And they were. Well, PDP-11, if you count that as big.
Yeah.
VAXs and such. They were always much more powerful than you could get on the desk. So, we waited. And until our kids came along and they needed something, so we got an Amiga 1000.
Amiga, yeah.
I still have it.
Do you?
Yeah.
You ever boot it up?
I haven't for a few years.
Yeah. We have one. I think the one we have is it a 4000? We have one in the basement. Yeah. We trot it out every once in a while. We had it up here on Saturday. We were interviewing the guy. A guy who's still selling floppy disks. And so we brought everything up in the basement that still supported floppy disks, including an Osborne 1, an Amiga.
There's a bunch of those in the Computer History Museum.
Yeah, too. Yeah. I have one of my own downstairs. Unfortunately, it's my history. So did you stay in music and chemistry, or did you get interested in computers at some point?
I got interested in classical Greek, Koine Greek. For a while, I was pre-med major, but probably not because I really wanted to be a doctor. I just wanted to take a whole bunch of different sciences.
Yeah, see, that's what I did.
Not just chemistry. I got tired.
I was a Chinese major. I was interested in stuff, right?
Yeah,
it wasn't
I've always had the problem of being interested in too many things. And but eventually, while I was stretching out my college career, I was working full-time and taking one course a quarter and met my wife, and we got both interested in linguistics.
I love linguistics.
We're planning to be field linguists in Africa. And so we were studying with a professional linguistic organization that also works with a missionary organization. We were going to go out and be Bible translators. So I learned a lot about languages. I had to create my own major, however, because the linguistics major at our college required two foreign languages. So I had all the basic courses and one language, which was Greek, and I persuaded them to substitute a smattering of computer languages for the other language requirement. And my major was called Natural and Artificial Languages.
Very
And I thought I was doing it just to get out of school. It turned out to be quite a prediction of what my future career was going to be.
Yeah.
I didn't know it at the time, though.
Do linguists consider computer languages kind of languages, human languages?
Most of them don't. They think both the linguists and the computer scientists tend to think of computer languages more as a mathematical sort of construct.
A formal description of a problem and solution.
And I felt it was my specialty to be able to take some of the ideas from how a natural language works and apply them to computer languages.
There are nouns, there are verbs.
Yeah, right? Yes, but not so much on a surface level. People think, well, you could just make English like COBOL, but that's a very surface level of how a human language works. The deeper ways in which we use metaphors and things that are similar to each other, take this and use it as that, and let them kind of interplay in a computer scientist would call it, in a Dwimmy fashion, do what I mean.
Right.
And how do you do that without losing control of what the computer is going to do is an interesting problem.
Well, it makes sense because, after all, the human brain works in a particular way. Language is our particular facility as humans. And if you're going to try to get a computer or a machine to do something, it makes sense that whatever mechanism you use to do that is going to end up being kind of linguistic because that's how we communicate, right?
Certainly. And a lot of people think that the purpose of a computer program is to speak to the computer.
Like a conversation.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's just as important, the communication with the other programmers around you and to your future self.
More importantly, yes.
As I say, I always assume that whoever reads your code is an axe murderer with a grudge. And
one of my favorite.
And that might even be you.
Yeah, one of my favorite quotes.
6 months from now.
So this was at University of California, Berkeley, as a graduate student.
As a graduate student.
You met Gloria, who is here, by the way.
Well, we actually met up at Seattle Pacific University.
Oh, you met at Seattle Pacific.
Yeah.
She's going, no.
Yeah.
Seattle Pacific. But then you both went to Cal.
Yes, we did. We were both in the linguistics program there. Yeah. Met some really famous linguists. George Lakoff, Charles Fillmore were some of our professors.
Do you still love linguistics? Is that still a...
You can't stop loving linguistics.
Yeah.
The way it often comes out, though, is my wife complains that anything she says to me, if there's any ambiguity in it whatsoever, I will misinterpret it intentionally.
Oh, thank goodness for the holes. That's really... Well, but that's what's interesting.
That's actually what takes it takes that to be a good language designer, because a lot of people think they're good language designers, but they don't see where the holes are,
right?
Where the ambiguities are and the traps that people will fall into.
And ambiguity, of course, is not what you want when you're instructing a machine to do things.
You don't want unintentional ambiguity,
right?
Or as we say, unintentional genericity, to use a more technical term. And this is actually one of the reasons why we decided to redesign Perl in starting in the year 2000, was there were some places there where it was unintentionally generic, unintentionally ambiguous. So that was part of the process. It's always a learning thing. You're never perfect on it.
Of course not.
And there is no such thing as a perfect language, because one of my favorite books is by Umberto Eco. It's called The Search for the Perfect Language. And it's not about computers. It's about all these ancient ideas of how a perfect language should work. Is it Hebrew? Is it Latin? Is it some philosophical language that I can make up? Is it Lojban? Esperanto?
Right.
And there's always trade-offs. The good language designers, it's funny, we all get along quite well with each other. It's our followers that tend to get into fights because we all understand that how many trade-offs we made,
right?
And which trade-offs we made. So, ambiguity. What we've discovered, a lot of the problem is assuming that you can parse a piece of program and then go back and reparse it as some other language, you know, in retrospect, you know,
right,
in reverse, and that is how usually you end up with accidentally being in more than one language.
Right. I've heard it said that the language really conditions what you think you can do and what you can do.
Yeah, you can either have a strong or a weak Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. Right. I'd buy the weak one, but not the strong one. Languages don't really differ in what you can say. They differ in what they make easy.